In the 25 years since German reunification, literature has played a key role in coming to terms with the legacy of the East German dictatorship. Although GDR writers found themselves seriously compromised at the regime's end by allegations of collaboration with the infamous secret police, the Ministerium für Staatssicherheit, or the Stasi, as I'll call it, many have continued to tackle questions of transition to democracy, including questions of guilt, responsibility, shame, and transitional justice. Most vocal among writers from the East have been the group of exiled writers who were victims of Stasi persecution in the 70s and 80s. But there's also been voices like Christa Wolf, who is known to an international audience, and she was, interesting, both a victim and a collaborator, but has a much fatter victim file than a collaborator's file. These writers have written both fiction and non-fiction and contributed substantially to our knowledge of the injustices perpetrated and to the search for truth and reconciliation more broadly. Far less audible in this process have been the voices of former collaborators, such as writers who were exposed as Stasi informers, despite the fact that it was revealed that the entire field of literature, from writers, publishers, reviewers, editors, to book commissioners, had been massively complicit with the communist regime and also infiltrated by the Stasi. In this paper, I'll revisit the slippery case of Stasi informant Sascha Andersen, who was an avant-garde poet, musician, actually more of a singer, but he played in avant-garde bands, and an art book producer in the Berlin underground known as the Prenzlauer Berg Scene or Scene. He was born in Weimar in 53, and Andersen is regarded as one of the regime, or was regarded as one of the regime's shooting stars in the mid-80s, but was severely discredited in 1991 when he was exposed as a secret police operative and major source of intelligence for the Stasi. Since then, Andersen has continued to write sporadically, publishing mainly volumes of poetry, and in 2002, an autobiography that I look at, none of which has succeeded in having any impact on his outsider status in literary circles. In a radical rewriting of literary history by all but his closest friends, Andersen's literary production was deemed unnecessarily defensive, hermetic, unrepentant, and even pathological. And that's something he picks up on himself. His autobiography, in particular, was panned by critics for his inability to produce an honest confession and an admission of wrongdoing, whereas his more recent work of autobiographical fiction, The House of the Dead, has been more positively received. In rereading Andersen's oeuvre in terms of its merit and interest for questions of truth and transitional justice, the question I ask myself is, what of Andersen's work will endure? Will it be the therapeutic, confessional storytelling of his early poems, in which he was not only working undercover, but, I argue, writing undercover as well, confessing to acts of betrayal when his audience suspected none? And no one suspected him at the time. No one. Which, it seems a mystery. But anyway. Or will it be his fictionalised autobiography as an almost pathographic work that testifies to the schizophrenia of the double life of a poet spy that will remain, or indeed his latest attempts at autobiographical fiction? Oh, sorry. Okay. Now, the first section, his poetry. Much about Andersen's case remains a mystery, despite the copious amounts of ink that have been spilled on trying to fathom out the charismatic pop star, as he's recently been called, of the Prenzlauer Berg underground and the former darling of British and North American academic circles. When allegations were first made that Andersen had been a Stasi informant, the initial response from many was simply disbelief. It seemed inconceivable that the Stasi had infiltrated the bohemian subcultural circles which had been shunned by the cultural establishment, refused access to book contracts and to membership of the Writers' Guild. The Prenzlauer Berg poets, along with their dropout artist friends, eked out an existence in semi-illegality and asociality in the dilapidated housing at the rear of the suburb's inner city blocks, so in the second court, behind the second courtyard, in housing that was thought to be unrentable, and they more or less paid no rent for these apartments. They represented a type of third literature, distinct from the more overtly political writing associated with protest singer-songwriter Wolf Biermann, for instance, and the often self-censored modernist writing of older established writers such as Christa Wolf herself. Andersen belonged to an emerging group of younger writers who eschewed all naive realism and conventional forms of political activism, embracing instead the traditions of Dadaism, Surrealism, concrete poetry, beat, and the avant-garde. They were not only aesthetically diverse, their theoretical impulses were equally broad, ranging from Foucault, Derrida, Deleuze and Guattari, and to Jean Baudrillard. And there's probably more. The socialist project of East Germany and East Berlin's cityscape, with its impassable borders and its concrete jungle, form part of a stifling, claustrophobic traumascape from which its fringe dwellers never wanted to escape or were ever able to fully embrace. Poet Urs Grünbein, perhaps the most successful member of the group, captures the sense of being, I quote, an object of a cynical historical joke in one of his poems from March 1989. He describes his generation as being, I quote, the sick father's brood are we, the wall's precipitous delivery or labour. While a good number of them eventually left for the West, like their friends in the West German left, they refused to regard capitalism as a viable alternative to really existing socialism. In many ways, they resembled the proverbial rabbits from a popular Defa film of the time, I Am the Rabbit, caught in the glare of the political headlights that were fixated on Germany throughout the Cold War. As such, Andersen writes in the first volume of poems published in the West in 1982, the political walls had by now become internal ones. I quote, I build my own walls through my body. One half rots straight away, the other half rots over time. Please excuse my really bad translations. His work hasn't actually been translated, and I struggled to translate. I'm not a gifted translator. Andersen's poetry can be roughly divided into the works prior to the collapse of Eastern European communism and those penned after. There is much continuity in style and his use of metaphors, and over the years his works have progressively become more hermetic, self-referential and dense in expression. Above all, it's the reception of his work that differs most markedly after his exposure as a Stasi collaborator. Early critics in the West celebrated Andersen's radical, disillusioned view of his country. His repertoire of eclectic references, pop references in particular from John Lennon to Yoko Ono, as well as references to soldiers and Poland's borders. They welcomed his fresh, cryptic, associative style, and responded to his preoccupation with death, powerlessness, fragmentation, alienation, and despair, mostly offering readings that highlighted the extraordinary circumstances and zeitgeist of Andersen's social and political milieu. The Lebensgefühl is a nice German word that we can translate as life feeling, of his generation found fitting expression in the poem's fractured syntax, broken rhythms, and his heavy use of enjambement. For instance, references to the death of the subject and to state violence were largely interpreted as ruminations on the plight of the Prenzlauer Berg poets, whose rebelliousness the state was only too quick to repress. For instance, the following poems were read as expressions of victimhood. This is prior to the revelations. I'm no acrobat. I cannot do the splits. I'm hanging with my white neck in the hot wire. I'm no acrobat, hence I'm staying here, even if thereby my heart grows cold. Another poem is given a similar reading. I wanted to find the formula for my dying myself and called my memories yellow. I have no expectations. Do you know things forget us quicker than we realise? And I don't know who it was. As late as 1986, Andersen was keen to stress the inseparable nexus in his works between his cultivated schizophrenia in style and language and the late Stalinist conditions that reigned in East Germany. Moreover, he actively contributed to fostering an image of the avant-garde poet as hapless victim of schizoid political realities, remarking in an interview, I've been deformed. I knew that I am a manneristic image of the surreal GDR. Prior to the fall of the wall, the Prince Albert poet's modernist-inspired declarations of the death of the subject and the author, the end of history, politics and morality, were an intrinsic part of the charm of this new breed of Eastern Bloc poet. As a new type of resistance to the status quo, and in the words of one of the major critics of the time, Anneli Hartmann, this represented a refusal of politics and a politics of refusal. They were welcomed by scholars in the West because they showed that communist art could be aesthetically complex and challenging. For the left in particular, the aesthetics and politics of the Prenzlauer Berg poets was proof that a subversive politics could be achieved through subverting language, syntax and metaphor. This was all to radically change when the first allegations of being a Stasi informant hit the press in 1991. Andersen's persistent denials throughout this period of having been nothing but a casual collaborator of little significance, and his evasiveness and slipperiness in interviews and the copious talk shows that were on television at the time, only served to condemn him even further in the eyes of the world. He had not only discredited himself, he'd single-handedly trashed the reputation of an entire cohort of young writers and artists, mostly young, whose life and work was traduced as inauthentic and fake, and a Stasi simulation was the dominant verdict at the time. While most sections of the Prenzlauer Berg were eventually, slowly, able to extricate themselves from the stigma of being Stasi infiltrated, Andersen's reputation was never to recover. Since there was no doubt that he had been a loyal collaborator from 6 to 10 years, there was little to salvage from the train wreck of his literary career, except, of course, his work themselves. And at the time, there was little appetite for doing that. Perhaps as a measure of Andersen's particular personality, he continued to publish throughout this period and beyond, at first with his painter collaborators, such as A.R. Penck, and more recently with his new wife, Alyssa Walser, the daughter of a literary heavyweight, Martin Walser. Martin Walser and Günter Grass are often, you know, the two sort of elder statesmen of West German writing. He has married one of Walser's daughters, who's also a writer. So, interesting. In his first volume, published around the time of the Revelations, the tone of his poetry is dark and cryptic, and he appears to anticipate his post-Revelations pariah status through ironic identification with the medieval figure of the eternal or wandering Jew, suggesting that in an era of identification, the poet and the painter are already misunderstood, wandering from star to star. As the back cover of Jewish Jet Set on the left suggests, through his self-stylations as one of the few copyright unprotected birds of prey in the cultural park of international poetry. Even before his Stasi connections were known, this volume was largely panned by the critics, who now confess to finding his cryptic poetics tiresome. Since the abolition of censorship, they argued, there was no need for such deliberate obfuscation. Readers no longer scrutinised texts for covert meanings and encoded messages, and writers did not have to compromise literary quality to get published. A similar verdict was pronounced with regard to later poetry volumes, such as this one, Herbst Zerreißen, on the right, in 1997, in which Andersen still insists on seeing himself as a pariah, I quote, booted out and hung out to dry in the valley. While journalists now found little redeeming features in his poetry, there were several attempts to plumb Aunt Andersen's work for insights into his secret life as a spy. And I've sort of summarised what I found in the secondary literature. Fellow poet Elke Erb, who was a great mentor of Andersen's, and US academic Christina Cosentino both attempted to reread his work, especially his earlier texts, in light of the new revelations. Both discover a wealth of confessional textual clues in Andersen's poetry that point to his double life as an undercover agent. They're found barely concealed with allusions to false identities, mirrors, shadows, halves, walls, train wrecks, hermaphrodites, Siamese twins, rifts, writing even under pseudonym, the binaries of power and powerlessness, loss of subjectivity, such as in the following poem. And there are these are the whole range of references that they've actually now found, which were, of course, all overlooked or read differently, should I say, read differently before. For instance, an example here. And so I divide myself, my dears, and I'm always the same. I know that the same ones return, only to be different ones. What critics once read as a symptom of the postmodern condition more generally, after 89, they started to read as a specific commentary on the double bind of Anderson's specific circumstances. Cosentino identifies a double schizophrenia in his works and is astonished to find so many not quite so encrypted biographical references to Anderson's secret life. Erika Erb argues that the poet, who is revealed to be a denunciator, is not extinguished as a poet. Although it's true, she admits, that we may no longer be interested in him and in reading him or knowing him, as in her case. Whether he is a poet or not must be decided by other moral criteria. She in turn is struck by the repetitive nature of many of his poems, which she sees as a sign of an enduring existential dilemma or trauma, which is far deeper and darker than the whole complex of his involvement with the Stasi. And one example that she quotes is this poem about Mary Westmacott, the pseudonym, in fact, of Agatha Christie. I am Mary Westmacott, and apart from this, that I, under the name S. Anderson, chase words into the double heart albums for the Rosencrantz of the generations, so that the sons can read from it the oracle of the 8th of January. I'm a romantic am I. And love your body and your mouth and the island of which you speak with it. But of course that's not all there is, because I'm Mary Westmacott, and lost the fear of touching your body with your hand and driving the novel to its bloody end in the barbed wire, which I beg you, just a metaphor I'm betraying. And even that is not all there is. For Mary Westmacott and the barbed wire are lies. I died as time went from now to now under the train station clock. I haven't quite been able to find out whether he met his agents on the train station, but he did travel from Berlin to Dresden to meet his agents. So I think the allusions to train stations are references to these clandestine meetings that he had with his agents. If read as a form of almost involuntary self-therapy, an undercover confessional, Anderson's poems from this period, it must be said, exude an enduring fascination that may well mean that his less mannered and less conscious work, that is his less mannered and less self-conscious work, that endures. And now I want to talk about the autobiography. In 2002, Anderson was partially brought back in from the cold when a major publishing house, a West German publishing house, Dumont in Cologne, agreed to publish his eagerly awaited memoirs, bearing the title Sascha Anderson. On first glance, the work lies somewhere between a fictional autobiography and an autobiographical fiction. In both of these genres, the link to actual reality or to the real world is tenuous or disturbed, as indeed it is with Sascha Anderson. A fictional autobiography is one in which the author adopts the persona of a person who does not exist and narrates the story from a first-person perspective. In Sascha Anderson, however, this is clearly not the case, because the poet and Stasi informant Anderson is his historical figure. The work is ostensibly a real autobiography, but I'll argue with a twist. It's an autobiography written by the historical subject, Sascha Anderson, who presents himself partly as a fictional construct. The subject of the autobiography is, as a rule, identical with the author. As the cover image indicates in the empty broken line running through the proper name, the gap that runs across the typescript of the proper name of Sascha Anderson, the subject of this work wants to be seen as fractured, split, or divided. Or rather, on closer analysis, the subject of the work is both divided and double, multiple, because the split is not quite through the middle. The autobiography gives little insights into the circumstances surrounding his enlisting and the nature of his assignments on behalf of the Stasi. The passages dealing with the entire topic are frustratingly imprecise and impressionistic. Some contain snippets of exact information, such as about the location of meetings with his officers in Dresden and Berlin, while other passages appear to bear no correlation to the facts recorded in his file. And I've done a fairly detailed analysis of each page. I've got his file. He has about 8 volumes of his file. And, of course, everything's meticulously recorded. There's no chaos to be seen anywhere. And there's the dates. I've actually sort of taken the dates. And that, you know, there might be mention of champagne being cracked at a meeting, or mention of him being sort of accosted in the street and said, you know, why aren't you keeping your dates with us, your meetings? And none of those dates are reproduced in the autobiography. It's really frustrating because it's all sort of slightly imprecise. But it's sort of there in a very impressionistic, dreamlike way. On Anderson's account, his first case officer from the Stasi was called Faust. And Anderson dubs him his Mephisto. Although, according to his Stasi files, his real name was a little bit more prosaic. It was Leutnant Graupner. Now, in playing on the classical German and European myth of Faust and switching the roles of seducer and seduced, Anderson deliberately blurs the boundaries between the Stasi and its young prey. Hence, Anderson's first encounter with his two officers in 1973, that I found on record, and which he actually talks about in the autobiography, it appears as a cross between a meeting between with a talent scout and a careers advisor. The Stasi wants to win the trust of its potential recruit, and the feeling, it appears, is mutual, since Anderson too wants to be trusted. As he stresses in the autobiography, there's no need for coercion or threats. Anderson's Ursinn, or primal scene of seduction by East Germany security forces, is oddly bereft of violence or force, and Anderson has no innocence to be corrupted. I quote, "No innocence, no guilt feelings." This is a pretty bad translation, but it actually reads very oddly. "No pain, no fear of pain, no fear of the pain that I do not feel. No legislative violence like that between Father Faust and his not-son Faust at opposite ends of the world. A busy void and the pain that I do not feel made me afraid of the pain, the indescribable." It's a very jerky sort of style too. After a brief training program, which Anderson was instructed to keep watch in his local cafe at certain times of the week, Anderson seems to lose interest in his handlers from the Stasi, although he'd been pretty keen to be enlisted. He has other fish to fry and undertakes a film traineeship in Babelsberg in Potsdam while managing to keep the Stasi at bay and missing his appointments. When the Stasi tries to pressure him to work for them again, Anderson manages to fob them off. We find a better record of his recalcitrance in his file than in his memoir. And in his file, we read that he often stated uncategorically that he was not interested in working for the ministry. He was too busy. He did not want to be an informant. He misses, as I've said, most of his rendezvous until he serves a 10-month jail sentence for fraud, after which the Stasi elicits a commitment from him to report on a more regular basis. Anderson suffers a perplexing change of heart in the autobiography, which is not elaborated at all. And by the time of his release from prison, he seems to want his handlers to reappear. I quote, "I waited for my case officers. They did not appear. Since the state did not show up, I assumed I was free, free for the absolute," in this sort of, on a single line. Another quote, "I suffered from the fact that my officers were not in reach, a fact that was a mystery to me." He writes in a revealing passage that points, I suppose, to his increasingly codependent relationship that he was to develop to the Stasi during the height of his collaboration. Anderson's main comment on his motivation during this period was that the Stasi's omnipresent at every illegal reading in the underground, every exhibition and concert, led him to develop an unhealthy, frenetic activism, and I quote, "a concept of production that appeared in retrospect pathological," unquote. Anderson evidently also sees no harm in his connections to the Stasi, even after the Stasi's demise, arguing that it was only natural that he sometimes turned to them for help. On his own admission, for a while, he played a cat and mouse game with his officers. In his autobiography, Anderson offers no admissions of wrongdoing and no apologies for betraying his best friends and others in his circle. He shows no remorse at the damage he caused to the group's cohesion, remaining defensive and defiant. He certainly did not inform on others, he says, so that he had an informational advantage, which he did. And yet he offers little in the way of plausible psychological reasons for why he collaborated, refusing to resort to common explanations such as the Stasi's well-documented use of fear, coercion, blackmail, and occasionally violence, but less obviously violence. He did not see it as work, he says, and he didn't see it as onerous, but as a quote, a function, a political function, a cultural political function. If he felt any guilt at performing this illicit function, then it was quickly repressed. Or, as he said, and he does have this interesting passage on guilt, he says he neutralised guilt or annulled it. He said guilt was something that he'd studiously avoided since childhood. He collected guilty feelings only to pay them off at the next opportunity. I quote, at best, I hated guilty feelings. He paid them off at best in the form of an invisible settling of accounts, once guilty minus once innocent, or the other way around, equals zero. Instead, he prefers literary explanations, such as that his collaboration was a Faustian pact signed with the Stasi devil, or postmodern explanations, that his collaboration was the product of a pathologically divided subjectivity, the work of a non-identical subject seeking not to become identical with himself, but to distinguish himself from himself. In another inversion of a well-known German romantic fable, he calls himself a shadow who had lost his Schlemiel. And it's Schlemiel, of course, who sold his shadow. Ultimately, then, the autobiography ends up celebrating the poet spy's amorality as a productive form of schizophrenia and his loss of identity as a philosophical conundrum, thereby mystifying his dealings with the Stasi even further. Now, I'll just briefly finish with, run out of time, and I don't have much on it anyway. The House of the Dead, his only work of fiction to date. Recently, there have been signs of a reconciliatory shift in the reception of Anderson's work. This was first in evidence after the publication of a novella, albeit now out of print, called House of the Dead, and it came out with a very, very small boutique publisher, not the major publisher, Dumont. The critical consensus that emerged in the reception of this work is that this heavily autobiographical fictional work might constitute the sort of honest, therapeutic storytelling that was missing from his middle period, which is marked by the defensive denials and self-stylization of the poet as pariah. Anderson's fiction, therefore, might well constitute an oblique form of storytelling, truth-telling via stories. The House of the Dead reiterates many of the same cryptic motifs of his autobiography. It's written in the same unmistakable, mannered, over-intellectualized and associative style. Its debt to the literary traditions of Romanticism, to the magical realism of Ludwig Tieck and Novalis, is possibly stronger than ever before. The documentary effects that we see in his autobiography, in the copious references to real names, places, projects, happenings, despite their inaccuracy, have been replaced by elaborate descriptions of Dresden's, not Berlin, Dresden's houses, windows, roofs, facades, stairs, rivers, gardens. The plot, which revolves around one rather odd secret police operation relating to a raid on the House of the Dead, on a house, is thin and underdeveloped, and yet, like romantic plots, full of magical leaps of the imagination. Anderson's spy, Friedrich Weiss, is, like Anderson, a go-between in artistic and literary circles, someone who tries to keep art and life separate but fails. Like Anderson, he too suffers not from a problem with self-identity, but from not being able to keep life and art, life and politics apart. And so he, like Anderson, begs his officers to be allowed to leave for the West, which Anderson did. And that's also recorded in the file. It's quite a heartfelt plea to be able to be let off and to be able to go to the West to be with his painter friends. In his complete In his complete works about serial betrayals, split identities, irreconcilable loyalties, and the thrills and conflicts of espionage work, Anderson may well have produced symptomatic documents of the Cold War and its afterlife, fictionalised pathographies and pathographic fictions of an entire society crippled by Cold War conflicts. Anderson many claim, and which a new documentary screened this year in Berlin serves to underscore, is possibly just a unique case of a pathological liar, an incorrigible narcissist, and a hopeless opportunist. Whereas conventional modes of life writing have failed to convince an exasperated readership and those who want some answers and truthful explanations and some apologies, it seems as if fiction has been, partially at least, to fill this gap. However, it seems doubtful, I would say, that Anderson will be remembered for the House of the Dead, but will rather be remembered for his early poetry, the poetry where he was working undercover and writing undercover as well.